You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 29th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Mark Joseph Stern, senior writer at Slate, on the crumbling wall between church and state in this country. Just another one of the new features of our current Supreme Court. Then Matt Stoller, director of research at the American Economic Liberties Project, author of the big newsletter on Substack, on some good news that's happening at the Federal Trade Commission. Also on the program today, January 6th testimony from Mark Meadows, lieutenant, ties the armed insurrectionist to Trump and the White House. Meanwhile, Ginny Thomas reverses, now says she won't voluntarily testify to the January 6th commission. Primary results in, one for three with Illinois progressives. New poll, confidence in the Supreme Court collapses as 33%. Only 33% agree with their Roe v. Wade decision. Supreme Court backs a lower court, blocks a lower court's ruling that ultimately will allow Louisiana redistricts to disenfranchise black voters. Turkey drops its veto of Sweden and Finland joining NATO, as Russia continues to strike civilians. And women around the country are denied all sorts of health care in the wake of those triggered abortion bans. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We are back and back in studio. Emma Vigeland.
Hello. How are you? I am back. I am well. I am doing well. I went on vacation.
Yep. And,
I saw a baby. My cousin has a new baby. And,
you're a little bit of a Wally Pipp situation.
Yeah.
Do you know who that is?
No.
You don't know who Wally Pipp is?
No.
Maybe you might want to Google that.
Well,
He was who, Lou Gehrig replaced.
That's correct. Wally Pipp got sick. Lou Gehrig comes in. Boom, boom, boom.
I don't know if you heard
it was on the mic yesterday.
So
wait a second. So did we not get the full headlines on the stream?
I'm not quite sure when
we need to check that in the future.
But point being, I saw a baby, and now I realize that everyone here, baby killers.
Oh, well, that's great. I appreciate that. That's
a
new dynamic for the show.
This is the beginning of my turn to leave the left. I saw a baby and realized that we have to protect all babies, born and unborn.
The first time you've seen a baby?
First time. And I realized that maybe our stance on killing babies at the show should be reevaluated.
All right. All right. Well, I'm willing to look into that.
Going to take a quick break, folks. Pick him off the show.
Yes. And then she goes off to huge success.
Blaze TV. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I'm going to make $3 million
new show on
next year.
She's got a new show on Colin and on Rumble. Is Rumble still around?
I haven't heard. There's locals now, but I don't know about Rumble.
Is Rumble still
out
there?
There's Rockfin. We didn't make any money off of that, but.
Mm. Had a chance to catch up with the testimony yesterday, at least the Hutchinson testimony. I don't think there was any other testimony yesterday. And there is some controversy around it because two Secret Service men who had relayed to Hutchinson a story about Trump's fervent attempts to get to the Capitol on January 6th. Supposedly, unnamed sources say they are now claiming not to have said that to Hutchinson. There were only two people in the car, or three people in the car, is my understanding. There may have been more, but I think there was only three. That was Trump and these two Secret Service people. Now, Secret Service guys, they don't want to come out and I don't know what this is. What's this? Okay. This is okay. All right. Secret Service guys are not really supposed to talk about what happens on their detail. They don't want this to get out. It's not hard to imagine that two guys who were a little bit loose with their lips, as it were, are a little concerned about that getting out there. They supposedly are going to are willing to testify. It'll be interesting to see if they will testify under oath. Nevertheless, there was a lot of things that Hutchinson said that has been confirmed and not refuted. Here is Liz Cheney interviewing the former assistant to Mark Meadows, Cassidy Hutchinson, on Donald Trump, what he said when he was told that some rally goers could not get into the area that he wanted because there were roving, essentially metal detectors that kept people from bringing weapons into the area. So in other words, a lot of weapons were confiscated. A lot of people decided not to go into that area and to stay outside the perimeter because ostensibly they didn't want the weapons.
Which was something that Trump took umbrage with because he wanted the crowd to be as big as possible.
And maybe also he didn't want people to be without their weapons. Right. Here is what he said to longtime Republican operative. She's only in her late 20s, but she had worked for Steve Scalise and others on the
Ted
Hill.
Ted Cruz. So she's a die-in-the-wool Republican. Yeah.
No, I don't know what this is. I don't.
These are the texts that are describing what you said between Cassidy Hutchinson. She says the crowd looks good from this vantage point. As long as we get the shot, he was fucking furious.
This is clip number one, right?
Yes.
Okay. Where is the testimony from Hutchinson? Okay, play it.
Yes. And the text messages also stress that President Trump kept mentioning the OTR and off-the-record movement. We're going to come back and ask you about that in a minute. But could you tell us, first of all, who it is in the text who was furious?
The he in that text that I was referring to was the president.
And why was he furious, Ms. Hutchinson?
He was furious because he wanted the arena that we had on the Ellipse to be maxed out at capacity for all attendees. The advance team had relayed to him that the mags were free-flowing. Everybody who wanted to come in had already come in, but he still was angry about the extra space and wanted more people to come in.
And did you go to the rally in the presidential motorcade?
I was there, yes, in the motorcade.
And were you backstage with the president and other members of his staff and family?
I was.
And you told us, Ms. Hutchinson, about particular comments that you heard while you were in the tent area.
When we were in the offstage announce area tent behind the stage, he was very concerned about the shot, meaning the photograph that we would get, because the rally space wasn't full. One of the reasons, which I've previously stated, was because he wanted it to be full and for people to not feel excluded because they'd come far to watch him at the rally. And he felt the mags were at fault for not letting everybody in. But another leading reason, and likely the primary reason, is because he wanted it full and he was angry that we weren't letting people through the mags with weapons, what the Secret Service deems as weapons and our weapons.
Okay, do we have the YouTube stream? Is that up? I'm getting now text saying it's down. So here's Donald Trump saying he doesn't care who has the weapons. They're not going to hurt him. And it's just more indicative of his awareness of what was going on in terms of the Capitol.
Yeah, and she testified a bunch of other things, like about Rudy Giuliani saying January 6th is going to be, quote, a great day.
We'll get to the other clips later in the program.
Okay.
We got to get through this now. We have sponsors, and then we'll get to Mark Joseph Stern in just a moment. I have a special guest in the studio again today, who reiterated that his favorite Magic Spoon cereal in the morning. Yeah, you're not coming on. I'm going to relate it to you. Were you changing your suggestion as to what the... okay. Cookies and cream. It's one of my favorites with my kids. I am, of course, a cinnamon guy, but we're all trying to eat better. Healthy breakfast doesn't have to be boring. Magic Spoon has the amazing flavors you love, but without all the bad stuff. It's also good as a midnight snack. So I try and get to sleep at night. I have now been enjoying Magic Spoon for, I don't know, I feel like 3 years, 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, it's awesome to have something that tastes so good and has no sugar and garbage. And it's also nice to be able to feed that to our children.
You don't want to feed your children garbage?
No, I don't. Sometimes that's what they want, but they enjoy the Magic Spoon. Most Magic Spoon flavors, besides Honey Nut, have 0 grams of sugar. Honey Nut has only one. There's only also 13 to 14 grams of protein, only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. Plus, there's only 140 calories per serving. Magic Spoon is keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, and low-carb. You can build your own box. They have 9 available flavors, and you can customize your bundle. Cocoa, fruity, frosted, peanut butter, cookies and cream, maple waffle, blueberry muffin, cinnamon roll, and honey nut. And even more exciting, Magic Spoon just brought back their cereal bars. They were so popular, they even brought them back permanently. It's the perfect convenient on-the-go companion for your cereal. Go to magicspoon.com/majorityreport, grab a custom bundle of cereal. Be sure to use our promo code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout to save $5 off your order. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Use the code MAJORITYREPORT to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode. We're going to take a quick break, and, oh, I should also say, Just Coffee mistakenly yesterday said that it was ending yesterday. It is not. You still have 2 more days, including this one, to get 25% off at justcoffee.coop. All you got to do, use coupon code MR25, 25%. Great time to try their different varieties of coffee. Dark roast, medium roast, light roast. They have all sorts of sources for their coffee. They're employee-owned. Great company. JustCoffee.coop. 25% off for 2 more days. MR25. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back with Mark Joseph Stern. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Joining us, Mark Joseph Stern, journalist, or senior writer, I should say, at Slate. Mark, here, Emma Vigeland. So a couple of cases dropped today, but also yesterday. We've had obviously a lot of things that have happened in the couple of days since we've spoken to you last. There are two cases I want to start with because they both have to do with the separation between church and state, which seems to be, quickly becoming a relic from a bygone era. Let's start. I don't know. Why don't we do them chronologically? Let's start with Carson v. Macon. This is a case out of Maine. Tell us about this.
So this case involves a unique feature of Maine's education system, but there is nothing about the holding that limits it to Maine. So Maine is a pretty big state with lots of rural areas where the state cannot afford to build or run public schools. So in those regions, it instead gives money to families to spend at private schools that the state intends to function as substitutes for public schools. So it has these requirements that private schools have certain curricula to receive this money, that they have to teach these subjects, and that they cannot be overtly religious. Now, that doesn't mean they can't be affiliated with religion. Lutherans can set up a school and it can be formally affiliated with Lutheranism, but the actual curriculum has to be secular because, again, these are supposed to be stand-ins for public education in places where it's just not possible. And in Carson, the Supreme Court struck down the requirement under state law that schools must be secular in order to receive this money and said that it is a discrimination in violation of the First Amendment's free exercise clause for Maine to attempt to preserve the separation of church and state by refusing to spend taxpayer dollars sending children to overtly religious private schools that do not just educate them, but indoctrinate them with explicit Christian values.
And would also, those schools could also theoretically, and very often do, we're not going to have gay teachers. We're not going to, I mean, you know, it would be a bit of a throwback, but we're also only going to have white teachers. We're not going to, I mean, there could be a whole host of things that their, you know, religious doctrines, would be discriminatory based upon any other sort of, context.
Yes, and also these schools that are now set to receive money also discriminate against religious minorities. So they teach students, for instance, that Islam is an evil and untrue religion that violates the tenets of Christianity. They do not accept Jewish kids. They do not accept Hindu kids. They discriminate against the children of same-sex couples, even if those kids are straight. They are, in all the ways that are possible, extremely discriminatory and bigoted, frankly, against the very public that they are supposed to be serving by standing in for Maine's public education system.
Does it also inhibit the ability of Maine to set specific standards in terms of what they're taught? Because, you know, I know, just for an example, there are yeshivas in parts of Brooklyn, religious schools where, they're not necessarily taught a lot of things that you need in terms of math and science. I imagine there are also some Christian fundamental schools. There could be other. I'm not familiar necessarily with Muslim fundamental schools where creationism has as much time on the curriculum, if not more, than the idea of like biology or, other sciences. Where does the imposition, can Maine still maintain certain curriculum requirements?
So I think that's the right question to ask, along with whether Maine can even require secular teaching in public schools. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the answer is whatever five justices want it to be. I think the logical implication of this decision is that the answer is no, because the court essentially holds that states do not have a compelling or important or even legitimate interest in maintaining secular systems of public education. The court equates secularism with anti-religious discrimination and says that under the Free Exercise Clause, it is discriminatory for states to mandate that schools be teaching only civic education or secular education, and that to gag schools from teaching religious education is, again, unconstitutional. Now, the holding in this case only applies to private schools. And so I think in your example, the answer would be that New York cannot force yeshivas to teach secular education, that states cannot require private schools to maintain certain curricula that adhere to basic standards. And then the next question becomes, well, what about in public schools? And this touches on the next case we'll discuss, but can a state say you're not allowed to indoctrinate students with religion? You're not allowed to express overt religious ideology in the classroom? Again, I think the answer under this decision is no. And the real question is, how far are Brett Kavanaugh and John Roberts willing to go in eroding the secular foundations of our public school system?
And just to clarify what I meant by with Maine is that you don't get these funds. You're not eligible for these funds because this is a function of Maine having this unique or supposedly unique dynamic where they subcontract to private schools public school education because they don't have the facilities there. But they do have requirements as to what those private schools must teach in terms of curriculum because, you know, to be eligible for that funds. Can they impose that same standards on religious schools? Or would that be problematic?
I think it would clearly be problematic under this ruling. Again, I think the only way a state can impose those standards is if it has a strong interest in doing so. That the state needs to be able to articulate some kind of reason why it is imposing these curricula standards. And the decision in Carson says that secularism is off the table, that, say, teaching real science rather than creationism is presumably off the table as a strong state interest, because, again, the court deems that to be discriminatory against religion. So, you know, every state does this a little differently, but the upshot of Carson is that courts are going to assume that any kind of secular requirements are unconstitutional unless the Supreme Court says otherwise.
Okay, so I have one other question. So Maine does this thing where they subcontract it out. But doesn't and you know, ostensibly that's somewhat unique because it's such a rural state.
Right.
But my understanding is, or specific knowledge of this, that if I have a student in a public school that has a specific learning challenge, and the public school, I can show that the public school does not have the sufficient resources to teach my child because of their challenges, the school system is obligated to fund my child attending a special school. Maybe they're severely dyslexic. I don't, without getting into the specifics of what, but maybe that's the dynamic. Does Carson then hold in that situation where it's not a regular feature of the, where I'm, you know, subcontracting entire school districts to private schools and therefore can't discriminate between, you know, religious and secular schools. But in this instance, does that then open up some, you know, a yeshiva, for instance, to say, like, we get funding too because you're giving funding to that school that helps kids with certain other learning challenges. The public school's doing that, and so we get it too.
Absolutely. I have no doubt that under those circumstances, if a religious school were excluded from that program and they tried to gain access by filing a lawsuit, that this Supreme Court would side with them, and that if the lower courts felt differently, that this Supreme Court would step in. Because again, this Supreme Court has established a rule that discrimination against schools on the basis of religion is impermissible, despite the Establishment Clause, which basically doesn't exist anymore, according to this court. And that, you know, if there is any kind of program that is taking kids out of the mainstream public school system, out of the schools that are actually run directly by the government for most kids, and putting them in any kind of alternate program, whether it's through this weird main system or through vouchers or tax credits or scholarships, that religious schools have to be able to compete for those students and accept those students. And anything less is a violation of free exercise. So I think that is, again, the right question to be asking. And in that circumstance, I am certain that a majority of this court would say, yes, the yeshiva has to be able to absorb the students with learning disabilities, even if they aren't going to be providing them with the education that they deserve and would get in a secular alternative program.
Two questions. One, is this going to be an easy conduit for the Supreme Court to target sex education potentially in schools under religious free exercise claims? And secondly, do you perceive them in the way that Thomas does, which is just throwing out these, hey, Republican state legislatures, go after this in this particular area, going after the precedent? Was it Edwards v. I'm blanking on the last part of that, said teaching creationism in schools is unconstitutional from the 80s. Would that be a way for them to more explicitly go after that kind that as well?
If you combine Carson with Kennedy v. Bremerton, the other case we'll discuss, then I think you have a clear roadmap for red states to not only roll back things like sex education, but to restore things like creationism, intelligent design, and other overtly religious topics in school. Because, you know, here we have the court saying that secular education, not actually a state interest. States don't have any kind of historical, compelling constitutional reason to insist that its education system remain secular. And then if you look at Kennedy, which we'll talk about soon, the court basically says that schools are free to inject religion into their day-to-day operations, that school officials are free to engage in religious exercise. And unless they literally force students to join them, unless they tell students, you must pray with me, then they are not violating the Establishment Clause. And under that test, I think creationism would absolutely pass.
All right, let's move to Kennedy. This is the case coming out of Washington State, where you had a football coach who, after each game, would go out into the center of the field and start to pray. And depending on whether you want to believe your lying eyes or whether you want to believe Neil Gorsuch, there's some dispute there. But before we get to I don't know if it's best to start with a factual dispute. Let's start with the legal dispute here. Why don't we just start with what is the Lemon Test, as it was called?
So the Lemon Test, as it's applied by the court up until yesterday, asks whether some kind of government law or action creates the sense to a reasonable observer that there is an endorsement of religion. So if you are a reasonable person and you see some law or some government action and you think that that's either endorsing a particular faith, a particular sect, or endorsing religion over non-religion, then that violates the Establishment Clause, because the fundamental rule of the Establishment Clause has to be government neutrality toward religion and toward religion or non-religion. The government cannot be seen as creating insiders in groups who share this official religion that's endorsed by the state, and out groups of people who are sort of left out in the cold and not a full part of the political community because they don't share the majority religion. That was the Lemon Test as applied by the court. That was the rule until this week when the Supreme Court overturned it in the Kennedy case.
There are three aspects of the Lemon Test, right? I mean, the way that you assess it.
Yeah, so there are, but really over the last 20 years, the court has boiled them down into this question of endorsement. Because the Lemon Test, the purpose was, the whole idea of the Lemon Test was we want to look at the purpose of laws, we want to look at the effect of laws, we want to look at how entanglement can happen between church and state in the, if these laws are passed. And I think the court did a very good job in more recent cases, Sandra Day O'Connor, this was sort of her mission, to boil that down into a more coherent test that just looks at the question of endorsement. Does it look like a law is endorsing religion? Is the purpose of a law to endorse religion? Is this endorsement going to send a message that there are in-groups and out-groups?
Now, and so in this instance, does it turn on the facts? Like, I mean, here's the thing that I find confusing about this, because generally the facts of the case are largely, well, are, it seems to me, rarely in dispute by the time you get to the Supreme Court. I mean, that's the whole point is not that the facts are settled. And then we just make a determination as to what the law says in this instance. I mean, it's, you know, or maybe how the law even applies to these facts, but this feels like it turns on the facts in a way that is, it's very odd. Isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's odd in the sense that the facts are fundamentally contested and that, as Justice Sotomayor illustrated in her dissent, you know, one side is telling the truth and one side is lying, because we have photographic evidence of what actually happened here. And the whole case seemed to turn on this question of, if you look at the photographic evidence, is there endorsement of religion? And if you look at the pictures, there is a coach holding his helmet up high in a prayer circle with a bunch of students in the middle of a field, wearing his uniform smack dab in the middle of his official duties, expressing thanks to a Christian God.
Let's see. We have pictures of it. So let's put these pictures up. Here is one. Where is the others? There's the picture of the helmet
going
up there.
See, in the back with the helmet? Yeah. So if you're sitting in the stands there and you're listening to this guy give thanks to his Christian God, a public school employee in the middle of a football field surrounded by teammates, to me, I think I'm a pretty reasonable observer. That looks like an endorsement of Christianity. And I don't think it's really possible to interpret it as anything else.
Well, I mean, what seems to be even more dramatic is, if I'm on that team and I want to play,
yeah,
I mean, short of me being, you know, the star quarterback, if I'm standing like, you know, where the person who took that photo is, I'm afraid to show up to practice the next day.
You wouldn't even get to be the star quarterback if that was the guy, right? Like those high school coaches behave like judge, jury, and executioner, and they revel in the power that they get, and he revels in the power that he gets of getting his whole team to do this.
I mean, love that psychological insight, Emma, and I think it's spot on. And
I mean,
important,
honestly,
to this case. Yes. Because this is the other thing. We're talking about endorsement. There's this even deeper test that has, it's sort of like the ultimate establishment clause test, which is, are state actors, state officials, here the coach, coercing individuals into participating in a religious exercise that they don't support? Is it coercion of religion? That is what James Madison said. The number one thing government can't do is coerce religious exercise. And here it is so obvious that the coach is coercing religious exercise by sending this message to his players. If you do not join me in the prayer circle, you will not be part of the in-group. You will not be getting equal playing time. You will not be favored by me. And in case there were any doubt about this, students submitted testimony that they were ostracized when they refused to participate initially and only joined and kneeled and prayed because they felt that they were being mistreated by the coach and other school officials by refusing to participate. And again, that is the gravest sin under the Establishment Clause that courts had ever identified.
So where does this, I mean, this feels like it, you know, this, because it was always, you know, like a prayer in school, right? I mean, when we articulated this was always sort of the bedrock of the way that, you know, I would explain to, young children is to what does it mean to separate church and state? Where does this leave us? I mean, when we have all the RFRA stuff that we're anticipating, right? When we have, I don't know what cases we're going to hear next year. You have a better sense of that. But, we're not far from a whole host of things that people don't have to participate in because ostensibly because of religion. Like, we're expanding what constitutes an infringement upon people in terms of based upon their religion.
Yes. And where I think this leaves us is with almost no constitutional bar against school prayer, because what the court did in this case is hold that Coach Kennedy was in fact protected by the free speech and free exercise clauses of the First Amendment to engage in Christian prayer during the course of his duties at this moment on the field. And what that means is that schools now have a kind of blueprint for restoring Christian prayer. What they can do is say, well, look, we're not officially sponsoring this prayer, but individual teachers are free to engage in whatever religious expression they prefer during the course of their duties, because otherwise we would be violating the First Amendment and violating their rights. And so teachers can now engage in prayer in the classroom, subtly or not so subtly coerce students into joining them. And unless they tell students, you will be expelled if you don't pray to Jesus, there's basically nothing those kids or their parents can do about it.
Yeah, seems bad.
Yeah, I mean, do you want to talk about the facts and how the majority lied about them?
Yeah, I mean, that is, but does there, okay, let's talk about that, because it seems like if you lie about the facts, it is restricting the breadth of your ruling, right? Like, I mean, if I'm saying that, if in Gorsuch world, this is just a coach who quietly moved to the side and right after the game, you know, turned his back on everybody and, you know, got down and kneeled and did whatever he did and prayed to God quietly. It's almost like nobody even realized he was doing it except for, you know, one, finger wagger,
busybody
in the corner said, oh, I could tell he's praying. That's the way Gorsuch made it sound like it was happening. It's clearly not. We have the pictures. But doesn't that restrict the scope of his ruling?
So it would be nice to think so. And I certainly think that you could make an argument to that effect. And you just did very, very persuasively. Let me give you the other side of it. The other side of it is that until this decision, the court had said that when you're looking at violations of separation of church and state, you have to take the entire context into account. You can't just look at the one or two instances where the person was nailed for allegedly violating the law. You have to look at their behavior before then, the behavior leading up to the violation, because that is what gives the broader sense of an endorsement of religion. Not just these three games where the school district formally reprimanded him, but also, according to Sotomayor, the 50 games before that where the school district didn't know what was going on. And so Gorsuch rejects that, and he just zeroes in on these three games where, according to him, the school district took like official action. And so you could argue that that restricts the scope. But what Sotomayor says, and I think this is very compelling, is that is giving violators of the Establishment Clause an easy out, where they can violate the Establishment Clause willy-nilly up until they're figured out. And then once they're identified, once the school realizes what they're doing, then they can kind of go get much narrower, get much subtler about their violations. And if they're punished, they can say, well, I wasn't punished for when I was preaching the gospel of Jesus for 3 years in the classroom. I was only punished for that one day where I had a Bible on my desk and was quietly reading verses to myself. And so I think that by narrowing the realm of violations that courts can actually assess, Gorsuch is making it much, much harder for school districts and other government officials to tamp down on Establishment Clause violations by creating this artificial narrowness of the inquiry.
And they also lied as to whether he was fired.
Right. He was not fired.
Bizarre.
He was just canceled.
So, right? Yeah, he was a victim of cancel culture. So Gorsuch words this very carefully. He doesn't use the word fired, but he says that the coach lost his job because he was praying, which is basically the same thing. And it's not at all true. What happened was that the coach was on a year-to-year contract. After he violated the district's rules, he was placed on paid administrative leave. And at the end of his year-long contract, he personally declined to apply for a renewal and then moved to Florida. So he was not in any sense of the word fired.
Okay. Well, it just seems bizarre. Like, because this isn't like a complicated, like, you know, I can see how, like, well, you've got the facts wrong. He, you know, the sequencing of this very complicated, you know, machinations this corporate merger is incorrect. And therefore your holding this seems to be pretty straightforward stuff. I mean, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to understand the difference between he got fired, he got suspended. What's going on with this?
You know, I think that the Supreme Court majority today is in a rush. It really wants to check off a bunch of items on its agenda and is in as short a time as possible, because some of those justices still remember when Scalia died, they had all of these big opinions that they had to toss in a drawer and hold off for 2 to 4 years because they lost their fifth vote. And they don't want that to happen now. And I think what Gorsuch and his friends realized was, look, we're not necessarily going to have the votes when the next big school prayer case arises. So even though the facts of this case are not aligned with what we want, you know, where we want to go, even though we have to manipulate the facts to reach the conclusion we want to reach, we can just do it. We've got the votes. We've got the majority. So let's just rewrite the record, just blow past all of these falsehoods that the lawyers below gave us, pretend like this is what actually happened, and then use that new narrative to build law that we like. That's my best explanation for what went on in this case.
All right. Let me ask you just one last thing that's a broader general question. And that is, it feels like the lemon test is one of a couple of, like, I don't know, principles that the court is in the process of jettisoning, that they are, you know, and you gave us a preview of what we can expect with the EPA test tomorrow, that being the West Virginia, the major questions doctrine. But it feels like the court is sort of like shedding itself in shedding the precedents. They also need to shed the sort of the tools that have established these precedents. Does that make sense, what I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, look, the court overrules the lemon test in this case. Gorsuch actually claims that it was already overruled at some point, which is not true. And I think that what's important to remember is that these tests arose because the court felt that it needed to provide a set of rules that everyone could play by, so that everyone was working from the same playbook, and that even if they disagreed about how a particular rule applied in this case, everybody was on the same page about the ground rules. And this court does not want to have those rules constraining its exercise of power. This court does not want to have to run through these tests and doctrines and rules in order to reach its conclusion. It just wants to do whatever it wants as quickly as possible. And this is a theme not just in this Kennedy case, but also in the abortion case where it tosses out the undue burden standard, in the guns case where it tosses out this two-step framework that all of the lower courts have been using for ages. And it just says, we're making up the rules as we go along and the lower courts will have to catch up. And that really jettisons one of the only real constraints on the Supreme Court's power and gives it a newfound ability to just push off in whatever direction it wants without even having to bother to explain itself.
And it also feels like it's basically saying, look, Fifth Circuit, Eighth Circuit, you guys, we were all sat in the same conference rooms talking, you know, at the Federalist Society meetings. We know what our positions are on this. I mean, this is sort of like it is there. You don't need to apply some type of litmus test to assess these things. We already know where we want to go.
Yeah.
And you already know where we want to go. I mean, this is sort of like it feels like it's turning the court system into the same dynamic that I feel like is modeled, like I see in right-wing talk radio, essentially, or that whole right-wing messaging thing. There's one or two people at the top. You'd follow Limbaugh, or maybe you'd follow Hannity, and everything else, all the local radio stations would just basically crib the regional guy would just crib from basically their talking points. And that's it. We don't need you don't need to. There's no mechanism. There's no machine. We don't have to put it through some function to figure out what it is. Inputs are irrelevant. You just tell us the outputs that you want. And that's it.
Yes, but I would just add that the court is also winking to these judges in the lower courts that they should try to push these decisions as far as possible, that they should take these doctrines, these newfound legal principles, to their logical extreme, because that allows the Supreme Court to do this work much faster. It really speeds up the pace of this revolution, because the Fifth Circuit is constantly churning out new and ever more radical cases that ask the Supreme Court to push the envelope as far as it'll go.
We're going to have to catch up with you next week. Obviously, the EPA thing is happening. I want to talk about what happened with Louisiana. The court essentially basically chucked, I don't know how they can eviscerate the Voting Rights Act more, but they seem to figure out a new way of doing it on most every case that shows up there. We also want to talk about the tribal sovereignty, but we're going to have to do this next week, and we'll have a lot of time to digest this court session, which is I feel, even before tomorrow, has shaped up to be the most radical shift in American jurisprudence. It feels like you tell me. I mean,
I think that
1930s?
It's the most.
Yeah.
The most radical so far, but at the same time, this majority is just getting started and it has so much else in store for us.
Oh, lovely.
Mark Joseph Stern, I guess. Thank you.
Sorry about that. Prophet of doom.
Appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Stoller, Director of Research at the American Economic Liberties Project. We got to take our victories where we find them. And if sometimes there may be more like technical things and they exist, but there are some places in our government where some positive things are happening. And he has a good story on that. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. I'd like to welcome back to the program Matt Stoller. He is the director of research at the American Economic Liberties Project, author of the newsletter on Substack, Big, which I can't recommend highly enough. Matt, welcome back to the program. I'm here, obviously, with Emma Viglin.
Hey there, Tiger.
So, Matt, thank you. I'm going to assume that was
that
Tiger.
That was directed at me.
Oh, was that directed at you?
Yeah.
I thought that was sort of more of a plural.
No, just me.
So, all right, let's get into this. I wanted to bring you on because it's, I don't know if you've noticed, but there's not a lot of great sort of like positive things to talk about what's happening these days with our government. But there are, it seems to me, you know, sort of like two areas on the broader landscape that are where there are some positive things happening. And particularly in the context of the administration, I would say labor and antitrust. And you obviously your beat is antitrust. Let's talk about what's happening at the FTC. You wrote a your most recent piece on this was from a week ago, I guess, 2 weeks ago. Corporate bribery just became illegal again. That seems like a positive. it's good.
Nothing matters, but okay.
Right.
I can explain that if you want.
Yes, please.
So there's a couple of weeks ago, the Federal Trade Commission, which is the body, it's the government agency that polices our markets for unfair conduct. Side note, there's a reason you haven't heard of the FTC for 40 years. That's run by a someone named Lina Khan, who is a young, sort of aggressive academic type who has thought a lot about monopoly power, which is sort of an exciting academic and political area. And what she did, along with actually the unanimous vote, which is important for reasons I'll get into, is that they looked at the insulin market, right? And the insulin market is very messed up because insulin it's been around since 1922, but it's really expensive for a whole variety of reasons. But one of the main reasons is because there's a middleman in the supply chain between when insulin is produced and when insulin gets to a patient that causes the prices of insulin to go way, way up. And it's called a pharmacy benefits manager. And about 50 to 70% of the cost of insulin just goes to that middleman. And that middleman has deals with lots of insurance companies and basically says, if you producer of insulin want to get to the patient, you have to give us a bribe or a rebate. And that rebate has gone up to 50 to 70% of the price of insulin. And this middle, we have dominant middlemen throughout the economy. Now, as it turns out, there is a law that we have not enforced for 40 years called the Robinson-Patman Act, which prohibits, among other things, corporate bribery. It says that a middleman is not allowed to get paid for anything but services rendered. They're not allowed to get these kickbacks. And what the FTC did is they said, hey, we have this law, and we're going to put out a statement of policy saying that even though we haven't enforced it for a long time, we're going to start enforcing it. And judges and lawyers and class action lawyers and anybody who has authority to bring cases under this law should start doing that. And while they were targeting insulin because it's a very obvious problem, this is actually a pervasive issue throughout the economy. Corporate bribery is everywhere in our retail markets. It's throughout our healthcare systems. And if you restore the prohibition against kickbacks in supply chains, it could make things a lot more efficient, a lot cheaper. It could create lots of innovation and stop what is essentially going on throughout the economy, which is mass bullying of people who make things or sell things. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that is what the FTC just did. They did some other things that were also interesting, and these things are going to take a while to get through because the legal process takes sometimes months or years. But a lot of good things are kind of going to start happening in the next 6 months to 18 months that have been kicked off by this FTC.
Yeah, and I want to get to those other things. And we should just say, you know, folks can go back. I think we've interviewed Lena Khan a couple of times on the program back in 2021, maybe, and in 2018. So just to be clear, how does that dynamic work, the kickbacks? I mean, because when we conceive of kickbacks, it's usually like, I work at a company, I'm going to give you the contract, you put some money into my private account. In this instance, it is that's more of a personal kickback. But how do these PBMs actually sort of extract this money? Is there just no mechanism for an insulin manufacturer to get to? They just have a pure monopoly. There's only like three of them, right? Like McKesson and CVS, and there's one other, and they can just basically say, like, you cannot get to the retail outlet, which is the pharmacy, without us, and therefore we're just going to crank it up. Or why does it happen on insulin as opposed to even generics, for that matter?
Well, it does. It does happen in every branded drug, really, generics is a different problem, which is equally bad, but it's a middleman issue, but it's a slightly different problem. So how does it work? So a PBM is, it's always impossible to describe this business model because it really shouldn't exist. And so you're like trying to explain to somebody why something shouldn't exist, in fact exists. It's basically a spreadsheet. It's a business. They run a spreadsheet of drugs. It's called a formulary. And when a health insurance company has to cover patients, and they say, okay, we need somebody who can like get a list of drugs that we should cover for different conditions and negotiate prices for them, and we'll just hire this specialist who does that. That's called the pharmacy benefits manager. They manage pharmacy benefits, and they put together what's called a formulary, which is a list of drugs, and then what PBMs sort of historically have done is they've gone to the drug makers and they've said, okay, we'll negotiate you because we have a bunch of insurance companies together that are our clients. We have bargaining power and we'll try to, you know, negotiate your price of insulin down, for example. They should fulfill a reasonable, and then they handle reimbursements to pharmacies, and they, you know, there's a couple of other administrative things they do, but they're an administrator. And there's nothing wrong with that business model. The problem is that they should get paid by the health insurers or the patients or the pharmacies for reducing prices. But they are allowed to actually get paid by the manufacturers of the drugs, who they should be bargaining with, right? So I'm bargaining with an insulin maker, like saying, you know, Novartis, and I should not be paid by Novartis. That is a clear conflict of interest. However, because the laws are structured the way they are, haven't been enforced, they go to Novartis and they say, hey, if you want to get on the formulary and there's two other companies, you have to give me, I don't want the best price for insulin. I want the highest rebate, right? So there's three companies that make branded insulin, right? It's not just a brand generic thing. Three companies make, and they compete with each other. And they compete, and Novartis could say, I want the best price in terms and the best quality for our patients, or they could say, I want the highest rebate. And what they do is they say, I want the highest rebate for Novartis, and that's who gets on the formulary. And this does two things. First of all, it doesn't reduce prices, right? Because you're trying to get a rebate, and you're not getting the best quality or the best price for the patient. But it also creates an incentive for higher prices, because if you get a 50% rebate on a $100 drug, you get a certain amount of money. If you get a 50% rebate on a $300 drug, you get more money. So they want, the competition is for these rebates, which I called corporate bribes or kickbacks, to the middleman firm. It's not to the individual, to the executive. But it causes, you know, it causes prices, it causes competition for access to the patient, not competition for for better pricing. And the reason, I mean, that's a conflict of interest in the business model. The PBMs have also consolidated. So there's only three big PBMs at this point. They're also owned by health insurance companies and drugstore chains. So CVS owns both Aetna, and they own Caremark, which is a big PBM. United Healthcare owns Optum, which is a big PBM. And so it's, these firms are it's a very consolidated industry. Three PBMs control 80% of patients, what patients can get access to. They're also owned by drugstore and insurance companies, which introduces more conflicts of interest in that business model.
And just to be clear, the rebate in this instance is the PBMs are buying ostensibly the insulin and then passing that cost on to the consumer via the pharmacy. And the rebate happens at the sort of, I guess, in between there. It is stunning. I guess, when we hear rebate, we assume like, oh, okay, I bought this Lantus for $300 and I send in my coupon and I get $50 back. But they're doing it in the almost like in the wholesale level where it's nobody else can see that they're getting that rebate.
Yeah, I mean, there are also wholesalers. So the PBMs don't actually even, this is why I said they're spreadsheet. They don't even touch the product. It's not like they ship the drug, they buy the drugs and then they move the drugs. All they're doing is handling like reimbursement rates for pharmacies and then what gets covered. So it's like purely a financial transaction, set of financial transactions. There are also wholesalers. Wholesalers also use rebates, and that also drives up prices in that case for generics. But the point is that this rebating system, I mean, you call them rebates, but you can also
call kickbacks.
Them. They're kickbacks, right? They're meant to exclude others from the market, right? Because if you can't, the big guy that gets that, has a lot of market share, he can just say, well, you have to buy a certain amount from me and you get a higher rebate. And then at a certain point, nobody who's buying is going to ever find it worthwhile to buy from anybody else because then they won't get that rebate. And so then no one else can enter that market. Just even if they had better prices on certain products, the aggregate amount of the rebate from the big guy would exclude them. And that's what you see with like Walmart or a lot of other stores. It's like they or Amazon, they use they extract rebates and they use that system of kickbacks to essentially control entire swaths of the economy.
Well, that was going to be my next question, right? Is how does this affect these major massive companies like Walmart, which benefited from this for decades, Walmart, Amazon, other huge companies who've been able to skirt by, but when the FTC wasn't enforcing the Robinson Patman Act?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there was a paper to give you a sense. So the law, the Robinson-Patman Act was passed in 1936, and it was really passed to address what was the Walmart or Amazon of its day, which is a company called A&P Supermarkets or A&P at the time. And they used rebates to kill their competition and extract, get better prices for things like cream of wheat or packaged goods than independent stores could. And then they would underprice those independent stores where they were competing. And anyway, so the Robinson-Patman Act said, you can't do that. You can't induce price, what's called price discrimination. And you can't get rebate. If you're a middleman, you can't get rebates. Unless it's just purely for services rendered. And it worked for a long time. And they stopped enforcing it in the 70s. And lo and behold, that's when discounters and chain stores really took off. That's when Walmart became very powerful from 1970 to 1980. It was like its massive growth period in the 1980s and 90s as well, when this law wasn't enforced. Now, Amazon had commissioned two people, the former Republican chair of the FTC and then a Democratic staffer at the FTC. They together, a guy named Tim Mirrors, they wrote a paper on how Robinson-Patman, the Robinson-Patman Act was a bad idea. It didn't work in the A&P context. And this paper was commissioned by Amazon. So Amazon knows that if you actually start to prohibit price discrimination, they're going to have a lot of problems. And they've been setting up a fight over, make sure to keep Robinson-Patman unenforced for a long time. And what was really quite astonishing about the vote that happened a couple of weeks ago is that it was a 5-0 vote. So the two Republicans who were pretty kind of libertarian, pro-monopoly, very much don't like Robinson-Patman Act type of arrangements, they actually voted for this. And that's a signal to the conservative judiciary and to like that they should take this law seriously, which is a big deal. But Amazon, just to kind of like answer your question, Amazon and Walmart and, you know, the Target, the big retailers, like what they do is like if they're buying orange juice, which is a must have, right, for if you're in a supermarket or bodega, they demand a better price from orange juice from wholesalers than a bodega can get or than a smaller grocer can get. And what so the net effect is like grocers will tell you that they actually get or they can buy orange juice cheaper at Walmart. Walmart sells it cheaper to consumers than they can buy it wholesale, right? Because of price discrimination. Because Walmart can just say, if you don't sell us a better price for orange juice, then you don't get access to Walmart customers. And that effectively kills the supplier. So this is a massive problem kind of across the economy. And the FTC, I believe last November, started a study on supply chain constraints, and they sent essentially subpoenas to Walmart and Amazon and Tyson Foods and Procter & Gamble and a bunch of big distributors to try to find out how the terms of trade were, how they were dealing with supply chain problems, whether they were engaged in forms of price discrimination. And when you have a shortage, of course, price discrimination is not you're going to get better prices. It's Walmart, we get toilet paper before anybody else. And so what you saw during the pandemic is you could go to Walmart and get toilet paper. And if you were trying to go to smaller stores, you couldn't get toilet paper. And it's not that there wasn't enough toilet paper. It's just that Walmart said, if you don't give us toilet paper, we have in our contracts, you know, we will fine you. We can do all sorts of things to you purely because they just have bargaining power. And Robinson-Patman Act was designed to say, you can beat your competition if you have a better service, if you're a better store, if your products are better or cheaper, but you can't beat your competition purely because you are bigger and have more bargaining power. No winning through pure bullying or bribery.
They have bargaining power by their size built in already. So this is just like an extra layer to add for them to be able to bully out these smaller stores. Sorry to cut you off.
They have a lot of advantages from, you know, they have tax concessions and, you know, they get lower borrowing costs. And there's a lot of policy advantages to size. This is a big one. This is like one of the main ones. It's like, if you can't get orange, if your competitor can sell orange juice at the price that you buy orange juice and you're a grocer, like you can't win that. Like right. You're done.
And this is basically trying to inhibit what is known as monopsony, a monopoly that is from a buying perspective.
Buying monopoly, which some annoying nerd had to turn into a complicated word, monopsony.
I was saying it occurred to me that you were studiously avoiding that, and I just wanted to show that I could pronounce it, because it took me three years. Of people saying that word to me for me to be able to pronounce it. And so now that I've mastered it, I want to keep deploying.
Well, we're did on the first try.
Yeah, she's the first
time. It's the glasses. So that's why you have to, you know.
I have to be able to show that I can pronounce that word. But this like is, and we, you know, like I remember at the beginning of, or at one point during COVID, talking to a guy at a bike store, and he was telling me like, there was a certain type of tire he couldn't get, and he's always been able to get this. And his distributor couldn't even get it. And he went on Amazon to see if it was there. And not only was it there, he started playing around to see if he could order like 200 of these tires, some type of special tire, I guess. And he could, and he realized after talking to his distributor that Amazon was basically just saying like, we, you know, to the supplier of bicycle parts, we buy so much from you, we want it all, and you're not giving it to other people. You're not going to, you know, we're going to take it and basically undermine the existence of small bike shops all across the country because we want people to buy all of their bike stuff from us. And if we can corner the market on a couple of key products, they're going to go out of business.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, that's what they do, right? I mean, that's the whole point of Robinson-Patman. I mean, Robinson-Patman, there was a whole, there's a long tradition. You go back hundreds of years of protecting small stores, and it's framed as this kind of like, oh, you know, we have like, we're nostalgic for these, for, you know, days of yore when, you know, you had the butcher and the baker and the candlestick maker. And, but now it's, you know, now we have these efficient, like clean, technologically sophisticated firms like Walmart and Amazon that are awesome. And, you know, you're just nostalgic, but it's like, in fact, what's really going on is there's just a policy change to allow might make right. Right. That's what happened. It's not that Amazon or Walmart is more or less efficient. I mean, I'm sure they're more efficient than some firms and less efficient than others. But, you know, what's happened is we've allowed them to win by virtue of their size and power. And now you have like what you'll find when you talk to smaller, you know, people who have run smaller stores is that they differentiate their stores by saying like, well, I know my neighborhood better. So I'm going to, you know, there's a lot of, say, Portuguese people who live in my neighborhood, and I'm going to put this weird food that Portuguese people like, and I know what the students in my neighborhood like, and I'm going to put that on the stores, and it's going to be a real neighborhood store that caters to their tastes. And that's a, you know, that, there's no efficiency, like there's no, if you just bring a Walmart in, they're not going to do that, right? Because they're run from Bentonville, and the pricing could be slightly different, but effectively what's happening is, if you can't get certain products, the must-have content, the orange juice, the milk, you know, the butter, those kinds of the eggs, those kinds of things, you can't compete. You can't differentiate your product and create the you know, the neighborhood store that people would like. And that's why throughout America, you've seen this kind of wholesale destruction. You know, anywhere you go, you know, I like thinking about when you take a road trip, right, and you go and you do like you go to a rest stop. It's like the same. The rest stops all over the country are the same, but it didn't used to be that way. You used to have like, you know, there was regional variation and now there isn't. And that's because we said might makes right. Size is all that matters. And so we destroyed all of this rich, wonderful cultural texture. It has nothing to do with efficiency. It was just we made that choice 45 years ago and we're living with it today.
And we should say, the cost associated to society is not just, the cultural variety. This is about when a Walmart or an Amazon, bigfoots these small businesses, you lose your tax base in a community because when Walmart comes in there, they're making a deal to get a tax break. And so you're losing your tax base in the economy, in your local economy. That implicates your schools, your roads, your services. You're also all of a sudden have this huge player who has an outsized political power in your system. This is how you go from a plutonomy to a plutocracy. I mean, so there is, it starts with what you lose in terms of diversity, with the consumer. But the real implications are, you're losing your democracy in some fashion because you're essentially consolidating the wealth and the power in an increasingly small group of hands, and they don't care about the rest of society except for their ability to extract. Let's talk about baseball, because this is also something you wrote about last week. And there's a lot of interest around here about these minor league baseball teams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the DOJ, there was a Department of Justice is run by a guy named Jonathan Cantor, who is like Lena Khan. He's a kind of what we call a Brandeisian. So believes that, big corporations are dangerous. Generally speaking, you know, not always, but if you're big, it's likely that it's easy to misuse that power. And that's how he understands the law. And so there's a class action lawsuit against the major league teams, because what they've been doing is they've been shutting down minor league teams all over the country. Minor league teams are often like a really wonderful community event. They're sort of like franchises of the major league teams. And so, you know, you'll have a smaller city that has a minor league team, and everybody likes going, but to a major league baseball team, that's just an extra cost. And so they just shut a bunch of them down. And there's a lawsuit against those against Major League Baseball for shutting those down. And one of the reasons they were able to do that, apparently, and is that the Major League Baseball has this very weird exemption from antitrust. And the Supreme Court in 1922 said, they said, we really like baseball, so we're just going to give them an antitrust exemption. And the DOJ Antitrust Division filed a statement of interest, which is, you know, basically a way of saying, hey, in a private case, they were like, hey, we're the DOJ. We want to say something about this. And their statement of interest said, we really think that this antitrust exemption should be narrowed because Major League Baseball should not be exempt from antitrust rules, which they are, and use that to undermine minor league baseball teams and communities and the players who play for minor league teams.
And I mean, this is, we should say, like, you know, the idea was that our government wanted to promote baseball, and baseball said, like, we need a monopoly, and which means, like, they're the only buyer for minor league players. And so you cannot necessarily establish another minor league team. Nobody's going to play for you if you're not going to get into the majors from there. And they're abusing what they were given without the consideration of why they were given that monopoly in the first place, which was to promote the national pastime. But how big of a, like, I mean, when was the last time we saw stuff like this?
Well, I mean, so the other thing is that minor league baseball players are treated just terribly. They're often paid below minimum wage. Their food is pretty substandard. It's like pretty bad to be. And this was not the case. This was not always the case. It's like a relatively new development. What was your question?
Well, when was the last time we saw this type of activity? I mean, from the different sort of, I guess, antitrust agencies that deal with antitrust.
I don't think we've seen anything like this since maybe the 70s, or, you know, you probably have to go back to the, you know, I guess the, maybe the, you can go back to the pre-1970s, I think would probably be the right way to understand it. I mean, that's when we had a case against AT&T and a case against IBM, which were the two biggest companies in the country. And there was a lot of interesting stuff going on. So it's been 45 plus years since we've had a real attempt to address consolidated corporate power.
Could you foresee, well, because in the case of Major League Baseball with these minor league players who are treated, as Sam mentioned, terribly, or you maybe did, Matt, treated terribly, underpaid, et cetera. And I think, you know, right now the NFL is in the middle of a controversy, having to testify in front of the oversight committee over sexual misconduct. And, like, basically the only reason they show up is because of their antitrust exemption, which allows them to air on multiple airwaves, regardless of the market, et cetera. But in terms of the Major League Baseball one, that's particularly, and Bernie Sanders raised this, due to labor rights, mistreating these players and also shutting down these minor league baseball teams as well, and cutting the pay, treating these players horribly. And that's fundamentally a labor issue, right? Like, could you see this FTC wielding their power in other instances on behalf of workers and laborers, as opposed to, you know, the NLRB has been active as well, but could you see this coming from a multi-pronged approach from the FTC?
Yeah, I think you already are starting to see that kind of approach, both the FTC and the DOJ. The DOJ has brought several criminal cases around wage fixing. So when they brought one against a dialysis company called DaVita, where they said the CEO was trying to prevent his people from his executive team from going to work at other places. And they brought actually a criminal charge against him, and he was acquitted. But it was a major case, and they've done that a couple of times. So, you know, the idea of, like, you know, price fixing, people understand that, like, a bunch of companies get together and collude to raise the price of something. Well, the analog in labor markets is called wage fixing, which is when a bunch of companies get together and they say, we're going to lower wages, or we're going to agree not to hire each other's employees. And the DOJ is starting to get pretty aggressive in that area. Mm-hmm. And then the Federal Trade Commission is starting to look at mergers with a labor lens. So they're saying, you know, hey, this merger may not just be about the problem of increasing prices to consumers or changing the way that markets operate so that the product markets are less competitive or data or whatever. They're also saying, well, will this merger lead to fewer opportunities for people to work, right? Or so are they going to, is the labor market becoming more consolidated? And I think that the Microsoft Activision one is where you've actually seen some of that. So Microsoft is trying to buy Activision, which is an $80 billion video game company. And one of the things that you saw preemptively is that Microsoft said, and it's being reviewed by the FTC right now, they said, we're going to sign a labor neutrality deal with a labor union, I think it was CWA, saying you guys can organize, we won't interfere, you guys can organize Activision if the merger goes through. And that's what you can see is that they're trying to lobby the FTC by saying, we're going to treat our employees well. And that's new. You haven't seen that before because the labor monopsony, oh, there we go, I said it. I don't even wear glasses. The labor buying power issue hasn't really come up. I mean, it started a little bit under the Trump administration. This is not all, Lena Khan and Jonathan Cantor coming in. There's been a lot of work, intellectual work, journalism, chronicling how consolidated labor markets are, how there are non-competes, no poach agreements. So this is a kind of longstanding legal trend, and Khan and Cantor are just kind of supercharging it.
Matt Stoller, the Substack is big. You can find that, we'll put a link to it at, you can find it on Substack called Big, but we will put a link to it at majority.fm and in the podcast and YouTube description. Director research at the American Liberties Project. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. And we will inhibit our use of monopsony, despite the fact that I now can finally say it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget the Just Coffee sale. You can get the Majority Report blend there or any other coffee. You try them all. MR25, it's a co-op out of Madison, Wisconsin. Check it out, justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MR25. Good for a day and a half from now, probably 36 hours, I would say. And then it reverts back to the 10% off with Majority. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
My co-host David Griscom, unfortunately, came down with coronavirus. So I will be flying solo tonight.
What? I thought that was over.
Coronavirus?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's still going, apparently.
What?
Yeah, you can still catch it.
News to us.
And apparently the more you catch it, the worse the long-term symptoms are. So that's just one thing to keep in mind.
Great.
But David, I'm going to be flying solo. We do have an interview with Morgan Levy. She's a Austin Starbucks worker. We talked to her about what inspired her and their situation and how they successfully unionized. So we have that interview for you. And then I'll probably be talking about some Dakota news stories. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. And I'll be going live solo on Twitch too tonight. So twitch.tv/leftreckoning.
646-257-3920. Can't promise we're going to get to a lot of calls today, but that's the phone number. We will be taking IMs. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts!
Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone?
Fun hat.
Nomi Key.
You did it.
Fun hat.
point.
Let's go,
there.
Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon. On
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go smell it.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. You call it satire. Sam goes satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late. And the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.